are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield. I am a local Tacoma cannabis activist, researcher, and educator, and I'm joined by my host, Uncle Dig, who is a cannabis activist and veteran out of Oregon. How are you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I am doing great. The weather is unusually cool for this time of year. It was 50 degrees when I woke up this morning. The cannabis plants aren't requiring as much water, and it's reasonably clear as far as the wildfire smoke is concerned, so I'm having an excellent morning.
Yeah, we're kind of having the same thing up here. It's nice, cool weather, kind of like a fall day. Really back to that Washington State weather that everybody loves. And I'm really glad to hear the smoke is doing better down in your neck of the woods, because we were just down there like week before last, and we're going to stop by your house and see Uncle Dig, but could not because of the wildfire smoke. So it's really good to hear that that's all cleared up and the plants are doing well.
Yeah. So we had a little bit of unseasonal rain come through this last couple days, and it kind of dropped some of the smoke out, and then we had a wind come through that luckily didn't kick up too many fires, but it did kind of clear the valley, so we got lucky.
Yeah, we were down that way on a family vacation, and I was telling you before the show, we stopped through Humboldt, and I wanted to talk to the audience a little bit about Humboldt for a second in my experience. I actually got to stop by a dispensary down there, Dig, and it was really fascinating because in California, they have two different licenses. You know, they brought in their adult use, and it was kind of like the Washington system where they had to get rid of the medical, but they needed to kind of keep it. Well, in California, they did keep the medical around, and it was really fascinating. We went down to a little town called Arcata. You say you're familiar with that area?
Yeah, I have I've never been, but I have people that are have just moved down there. I'm trying to get out and visit them eventually.
Yeah, it's just a really nice area. We stayed in a little town, Arcata, and then we were leaving out of town. I told my wife, I was like, look, we have to stop by a dispensary here. It's like going to the Vatican and getting a rosary or a souvenir. I mean, Humboldt County and that Emerald Triangle is like the center of cannabis. And so I went there and went into the dispensary, and it was like that old school Washington style where you got to show your ID up front, and then they lead you around to the back, and then you're kind of back there. And then you have to, what I liked about it is you have to wait for the other people to come out.
Okay, cool.
So it's got that privacy thing, like the old school Washington dispensaries, where you're in there by yourself talking to the bud tender. And so, like, if you have a severe medical issue, you're not blabbing it all over the store. Everybody can hear about it. It's a nice private conversation because, you know, cannabis, medical cannabis does kind of have that air of privacy. You know what I mean? You don't want to be telling everybody in the store how sick you are.
Yeah. A lot of rec dispensaries don't have a good way of allowing for privacy. And that was one thing that's kind of unfortunate in Oregon, is that everyone went rec. But there are some dispensaries that are a little more privacy friendly, I would say, than others. And depending on the dispensary and maybe, let's just be honest, the volume you buy in, they may be able to kind of ask people to step outside for medical reasons or HIPAA if you were to ask. I don't know. I assume that you would have to develop a relationship with the staff there and maybe go when it's not too busy. But I think that there are ways that even recreational dispensaries where there are no medical programs anymore, like Washington, almost like Oregon, we still have a medical home grow, but I think we only have 3 medical only dispensaries anymore last time I checked. And I believe that was in 2016. So that may have changed. They'll try to accommodate you. I just don't know with what degree of success they'll do that. The recreational cannabis doesn't leave cannabis patients a lot of options to protect their privacy, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's why this place really kind of hit it off with me. And the guy was saying that they had their own special license. It was really neat because all the cannabis was grown right there on site, and you could look at the package. And I was we were looking at it when I got home, and it was harvested like 3 weeks before I purchased it. So it's really fresh, and they did the genetics right there on site. They got the terpenes listed on the packaging, and if you go on their website, they go above and beyond with their pesticide testing and all that stuff. So it's just so nice to go into like a real medical dispensary, and it got like a gram and an eighth for $58, which seems a little high, but if you're buying really high quality cannabis here in Washington State, you're going to pay $45 an eighth. And this was pretty high quality. There have been comparable strains I found here in Washington State, but it was a. Have you ever smoked a GMO, the garlic, mushroom, and onion strain?
Yes, yes. I'm partial to it. It's an indica leaner that I'm quite fond of.
Yeah, and these folks, that's what I told them. I was like, look, I'm here visiting from out of town, Washington. I just really want to come by and check your place out. And they had seeds for sale and clones, and I was like, I want to get something that is like quintessential Humboldt County, like something that is like made here, bred here, and it's like your guys' best work. And they gave me a cross between this Jilly Bean, which I, this is another strain, I'm not familiar with that one, and this GMO, which I have not tried before either. And it was 28% THC on there. Now, in Washington State, I would be skeptical of that. But I'm a little skeptical of that in California, but it was really strong. And I'm a little more confident in some of the California testing. And the cool thing about it, Dig, is it even smelled like mushrooms a little bit. It had that little fungusy smell, not like a moldy smell, but it did have that sort of mushroomy, oniony smell to it, which was really cool.
It's literally kind of like, you know, like a good indica funky weed mixed with mushrooms sauteed in a little bit of oil with some onions.
Yeah, it was nice. And then I got the other gram was like an Eddie OG, which I think is named probably after Eddie Lett, famous cannabis prisoner. And that was a very nice strain. Really, like, it's that OG effect from cannabis, which you don't really get a lot unless you get a really good old school OG right out of California. And it's that really kind of high, like heady euphoric feeling that the OG strains have. And they're really hard to find. But I'm just familiar with it because back in 2013, in the early days of medical, you know, then I kind of feel like you could trust more. If something was like, oh, we got this from California, it's an OG, which is ocean grown, could be a little more confident. Nowadays in the stores, I'm telling you, I've just lost faith here in Washington State. But that was a really great trip down there, and I wish I could get back down there and get some seeds because they got the seeds and the clones there.
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about, OGs, and how some of them have a particular effect. I'm actually chasing that effect with one of the seedlings I'm growing in the backyard right now, the Alien OG. I'm hoping that's going to have that effect mixed with some of my favorite features of the Alien genetics, which are a little bit of a discombobulating, unnerving high that not everyone probably enjoys, but I certainly find interesting.
Yeah, one of those really strong ones, kind of knock your head into a different place. You just kind of got to shake your head for a second and be like, wow.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're going to get on to our news. And our first story is actually out of Humboldt County. And as we were talking here just a minute ago, if people aren't familiar, Humboldt County is in what's called the Emerald Triangle there in California. And I believe that's Humboldt County. Do you know the other two counties there, Dig? I think one of them is Del Norte. That's the other county.
I think it's Del Norte, Mendocino, and Humboldt.
Yep. Okay. That was the one I was missing in Mendocino County.
But there's actually two versions of this that people have drawn up. There's the Tri-Counties in California, which we just talked about. But some people view the Emerald Triangle as a region from like Eugene, Oregon, down to north of the San Francisco Bay, and then out a little west and east. And that's a DEA delineation. So depending on how you draw it, Southern Oregon is within that zone. Or if you're Cali only, then you're talking about just Del Norte, Mendocino, and Humboldt.
And it is a hot spot over the years of police activity and cannabis growing, and really an oppressive police state, really, I feel like, when it comes to cannabis. And it's been there's a lot of poverty there, and there's a lot of issues. And I feel like a lot of that is because of the war on drugs and a lot of the stuff that has gone on there. And so what the county is doing, Humboldt County anyway, they are saying, well, heck, we have all these people that have been affected by the war on drugs, and now a lot of them can't get into the cannabis industry because they don't have money or they need a little help. So what they're doing is they're rolling out these $10,000 grants for people that are affected by the war on drugs that can get a grant to help with like business fees or like you need a consultant to come in and help you get your store set up. They'll pay for those kind of things. And that's real good because a lot of these people do need a leg up when they get out of prison.
Yeah, they do. And this is also going to help more independent farms be established in Humboldt. Humboldt independent farmers who are like lower tier, smaller plant count producers have had
probably
trouble
like
competing.
Store I went to there, yeah.
Competing in the market. A lot of people aren't willing to pay what some of that smaller scale cannabis can cost.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, that's why we should be allowed to grow at home. So when we do go out, we should buy the nicest stuff. But it's been hard for them to compete. They've been competing with, guerrilla growers in the hills. They've been victims of uneven, inconsistent, and incompetent enforcement. And that's across the board. Law enforcement has not taken the time to understand cannabis. So, of course, their efforts at prohibition are going to be ham-fisted, overly violent, and ineffective.
And so the county is saying, hey, let's try to help some people out and get this going. So that is really good to hear from Humboldt County. And it's sort of still sticking on. We got a couple story on prisoners today, actually. Next up, we want to talk about a local story pretty much, and that is a story that Marshawn Lynch is working with the Last Prisoner Project. And if everybody remembers, I'm not necessarily wanting to promote Marshawn's brand, but he started a new cannabis brand called Doty. And this is have mostly pre-rolls, I do believe. And he has decided to partner with the Last Prisoner Project as a Last Prisoner Project ambassador. And he has also given a financial assistance and help to prisoners that are just getting out of jail on cannabis charges.
So I'm looking at this article and I'm kind of reading in between the lines here. And this actually sounds like it could be a really cool program. So basically what it sounds like, and this is me ad-libbing a little bit, it's a 90-day program that will offer participants hands-on experience with a potential career in the cannabis industry. So it sounds like what's happening is Mr. Lynch is using this as a way to educate newly released prisoners on how to work with the plant within a legal framework. And I think that even if they don't get a job with his company, being any kind of cannabis worker with 90 days experience of being trusted in someone's garden or in someone's processing facility is going to help a cannabis business owner decide to hire one of these people, even with whatever convictions they have, because they've already proven trustworthy. So this is good on multiple levels.
Ah, so it's more more job training and help like that than financial assistance. Okay, and that is really good because, like you said, if one of the known things in the cannabis industry is they just go through employees like crazy. They just bring in people, and the people don't know what they're doing. They work them for like a month, and then they just get rid of them because they got stacks and stacks of resumes, and so it's really hard to get good quality workers. And that kind of leads to is actually if you want to work in the cannabis industry, it makes it real hard too because the employers, they just don't care. I mean, you come in and you look at them funny. They're like, all right, you're fired.
Well, and that's also you got to remember. Just like any agricultural crop, especially outdoors, cannabis is seasonal. And most of that work is going to be, you're going to be doing seasonal work when you first start to get involved in the industry. That's not necessarily high paying work. That's not secure employment. But eventually, if you're able to work your way up through a farm or get a job as a bud tender, it can lead to more stable employment. But, you know, working in the cannabis industry full time year round is in a lot of areas can be difficult. So I would suggest anyone who's moving to a state that's legal to work within the industry to save as much money as you can before you come out, because there's going to be a little bit of time maybe before you're able to find steady employment. Now, if you do come out, fall is the best time because there are more seasonal trim jobs, but they do not pay like they used to. They don't pay like they used to.
No, and it's a more competitive now too with the job hiring. So like you said, if you're trying to get a job in the cannabis industry, you might have to wait a while, and you really need to work hard on that as far as your presentation, resume, because you know, all, like I was saying, there's so many candidates that they're not going to pick you unless you have something. That you'll be at the top of the list if you have something like Marshawn Lynch's program, where you already have 90 days work, and then you get a recommendation from somebody like Marshawn Lynch. Wow, that's going to go a long ways in the cannabis industry.
Yeah, yeah, I think it will.
All right, so we're going to get on to our next story, and this is another story about prisoners, and we're going to go back to California, doing a lot of stories over here on the West Coast today. And this one is a story I wrote over at gondrepreneurs.com, and this is about the California Supreme Court said that prisoners could not have cannabis in – they could not possess cannabis in prison. Now, I know folks are like, well, yeah, duh, that's a no-brainer, they're in prison. However, Dig and I, of course, have a different view on this, and we'll get into the details in a minute on the case, but it's really, if you're thinking about prison as a way to improve somebody and make somebody better and have them get out being better than they came in, cannabis and medical cannabis would be an excellent way to achieve that. But the California Supreme Court said no, and the details of the case, just a little bit, the case stems from there were some prisoners that were charged. I believe it was eight of them. There was like five people that were charged with possession of cannabis in their cells. And they were actually given eight more years of prison time. And so the case had to do with, can you charge somebody in prison with more prison time when outside of prison people aren't getting charged with prison time for cannabis?
That makes sense.
So that's where that's where the dissenters came down. The thing came down 5-2, where five of the judges said, nope, you can't have cannabis in there no matter what.
Okay. So it seems like part of the problem is that they couldn't give people more prison time for cannabis possession in prison, and now they can't because of this decision. Am I understanding that correct?
Yep, that's what happened. There was an appellate court, the third district appellate court said, see, before it was, they said you can't smoke it or eat it, but you can't possess it.
And if you possess it, they're not going to add more time to your sentence. You're only going to, they're not going to add more time to your sentence. They may punish you other ways, but they're not going to add more time to your sentence. Now with this decision, they're able to add more time to their sentence. So now these guys are going to get those additional 8 years, which first of all is not okay. We're allowing the prison system to further terrorize people for using a medicine. They should be allowed to use the medicine inside, and they should be allowed to smoke or eat it however which way they want to consume it. And the state of California should pay to provide them with medical cannabis, because cannabis is medicine. And if they have a prescription for a doctor, the state of California should be morally obligated to provide them with medicine, cannabis or aspirin or whatever, just like they're required to feed and house them, which they're doing a middling job of anyway.
Yeah, and apparently they gave these guys 8 extra years for a gram. Do you happen to have the story up in front of you, Dig?
I do.
Yeah, could you go down to the last paragraph, I think, with the quote from the judge? Do you see that there? Where he talks about, yeah, we admit that 8 years is really harsh.
Yes, I can read that.
Yeah, read that to me real quick. It is unbelievable. Folks, this is white supremacy right here.
Some may well view an 8-year prison sentence for the possession of less than 1 gram of cannabis. 1 gram is the approximate weight of a single paperclip or quarter teaspoon of sugar, as unduly harsh. The wisdom of those policy judgment, however, are not relevant to our interpretation of the statutory language. What he is saying is when he says the wisdom of those policy judgments, however, are not relevant to our interpretation of the statutory language, he is saying, even though this is stupid and bad policy, that's not relevant. Whether or not this is a good idea is not relevant to my decision as a judge.
And that is ridiculous, because judges do whatever the heck they want to all the time.
Yeah, they do. They're like junior cops. They're worse than cops a lot of times, because they add years to people's sentences for arbitrary reasons. And they do so sometimes as a matter of a personal vendetta that they're carrying out.
Yeah, and if you go to over there and read this story over at ganjapreneurs.com, it really says like it sounds like this judge has a real big problem with cannabis. He was not happy. If you go down through and read the article I wrote with all his quotes. So that's what was going on in California. Now, it's kind of interesting that they even got to that point, because any other place is like, of course you're not getting cannabis in prison. But I really say that people, and it's just like cannabis out in the real world, Dig. There is cannabis in prison. So why are you trying to like beat people up and arrest them and terrorize them over it when it's already there? They just got to work a little harder to get it. But if a prisoner wants to get some cannabis, they're going to have to do a little work, but they're probably going to get it.
Yeah, the prohibition mind is one that's hard to understand. It's hard for me to understand anyone who's an authoritarian.
So the next article we're going to get over to is in Arizona, and it's still kind of on the same topic, but we're going to be talking about cannabis social equity. And we were talking about that last episode, and that was with Tahir Johnson. And when we're talking about cannabis social equity, we're talking about the idea that this cannabis green rush is going on, but because of the drug war, a lot of people, and those people mostly being black and brown folks that were terrorized by the drug war, have been left behind. And so that's what we're talking about with social equity. And so Arizona, good on them, in their Prop 207, they put social equity right in their legalization initiative. But there's a little catch there, Dig. They're going to give out 26 licenses, but there is no little rule or anything to stop somebody from getting one of those licenses and then turning around and selling it. So what they're afraid of is that somebody will come in and get that license and then start turn around and sell it for $10 or $20 million. And there's a couple of the Arizona Normal is really up in arms about this, and a couple other people that might be ready to go for social equity applications are really afraid that this might be what's going to happen down there in Arizona, because this is some of the things that are happening over in Illinois, let's say.
Yeah. It seems like if it's legal to sell the social equity license once you receive it, that's what's going to happen. I mean, everybody's got a price, and you know, $20 million can set a lower middle class or a poor person completely free for life if they're astute with how they spend their money and how they invest. So it'd be hard to turn down freedom from want for the rest of your life to be able to cultivate cannabis on a large scale. So I would urge people to try to think of these loopholes in these laws. We can see where they're making mistakes. So when your initiative comes up in your state, read it carefully and lobby to get it changed before it comes up for a vote, so that we can avoid stuff like this. The scene, the national cannabis scene, you know, Normal. A lot of people can see this stuff coming down the pipe and they talk about it. So if you pay attention, you can see where pressure needs to be applied to your local governments or whatever committee is trying to organize signatures or however. Engage early and you can have an outside effect on how people apply these laws.
Yeah, and they're really saying, you know, again, good on Arizona, because they're one of the few states that were a little more proactive on this. I know Virginia is another one, but it's good on them for doing it. But like one of the Miss Brown, I think her name was Zaza Brown, is a cannabis entrepreneur there in Arizona. She was saying that it's almost like they do this on purpose, that they leave these things out so that large coalitions of buyers can come in and swoop up and get these licenses. And once the licenses are gone, they're gone. Like right now, Washington State, they're not giving out new licenses. And if you want to get a license, you got to have 100K right out the bat.
Yeah.
So that is our news segment for today. Now, today we're going to do something a little different, folks, as far as our interview goes. And we are actually going to interview Uncle Dig. And that is because Uncle Dig was in Afghanistan for a little while. I'll let him tell you what he was doing over there if he would like. But we're going to interview him about cannabis just real quick in Afghanistan. And at the same time, kind of dig in a little bit. There will be a little information about maybe what we can expect out of Afghanistan, which is looking a little iffy right now. So let's get into the interview real quick, Dig. So just tell us real quick, when were you in Afghanistan and how long were you over there?
The first time I was there from July 2009 to July 2010 in the Kandahar province on the western side. I was deployed with an infantry battalion there. And then the second time, I spent 5 months in northern Kandahar from approximately April 2012 to September 2012. I was in the United States Army at the time.
Yeah, and you talked about this just for a second when I think we were interviewing Rick Barbero about the tie sticks, and mm-hmm. you talked about the Afghanistan and the cannabis fields. So tell us just a little bit about the state of cannabis when you were in Afghanistan at that time.
During the first deployment, and I believe during the second deployment, but during the second deployment, I wasn't in an area of Afghanistan that is traditionally known for large-scale cannabis production, so it wasn't as ubiquitous. However, the first deployment, where I was in southern and western Kandahar, cannabis cultivation was ubiquitous, both on a large and a small scale. And when I say ubiquitous, driving down the road, you would periodically see little four footer plants in like planter boxes on the front, out in front of shops randomly with like other decorative flowers. You would see like little home gardens of like five or six plants. And then you would also see large open fields of cannabis and hash plants that were being cultivated on varying scales. So it was cultivated there, maybe not to the degree that poppy was at the time, but it was ubiquitous.
Wow. And just a little aside here, in my perfect world, that's what would be going on in the United States, is people would have cannabis flowers growing wherever they wanted to put them, and we'd be living our life with this plant instead of locking it away. But that's just kind of an aside. So that's really neat, but and not neat that you were over there in war, but just the how ubiquitous the cannabis was and how they were growing it over there. And so are they growing it mainly for smoking and flower, or are they, I know the sort of the, you know, everybody, the hash in Afghanistan, a lot of people turn it into hash. So what were they mainly using it for?
My impression was that most of it was being processed into hashish. They do dry sift, pretty good dry sift hash in Afghanistan. There's some bubble hash as well. But most of the processed cannabis I saw was in hash form. I did see and hear about some interpreters smoking joints of loose flower. But I never saw anyone smoke a cannabis joint while I was there. I was not a cannabis enthusiast at the time, although I appreciated the plant's beauty and was curious about it. I didn't partake because to do so in the military is risky.
Yeah, you can get in trouble for that. So now we have the Taliban, and we spent 20 years over there. Everybody seems kind of shocked that the whole place is falling. I'm not some political genius, but I could have told you in 2004 that this was going to happen, and I probably was telling people in 2004 that this was going to happen, and a lot of people were. It's not just me, but a lot of people were saying that, hey, the Taliban are going to get this country back. What the heck are you doing? So now Taliban is back, and they're not necessarily very friendly with cannabis. So what do you think is going to happen now to these little cannabis gardens in people's backyards and even the big cannabis fields now that the Taliban's coming back?
You know, there's two courses of action that could happen. First of all, let's talk about 1991 really quick, when the Taliban first took over. There was a blanket ban on cannabis production by the Taliban at that time. I don't know how successful it was. It seems like maybe it wasn't. But there are some differences now between 1991 and now. The Taliban have taken over more effectively. They've come in with civil government positions ready to go. Whereas before, it was fighters coming in, seizing power, and then fighters trying to govern. They're actually having, you know, Taliban judges and stuff like that come in and start civil governments. So their hold on power in areas that they've just taken over is a little more complete and total than it was in 1991, and it's more efficient. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they'll ban cannabis cultivation. there's two schools of thought on cannabis and poppy cultivation. And unfortunately, in most of the literature I was able to find that's respectable, they're linked inextricably in the minds of most people, which I think is unfair, but it's the literature I've been provided with, and I can't find anything with better information. Because they're both drugs, according to the Taliban, opium, poppy, and in their version of Islamic law, I don't know that, at least intellectually, they see a difference between opium and cannabis. I think maybe the reality on the ground is a little different, but one of two things could happen. An effective ban could take place and the Taliban could really crack down, and cannabis coming out of Afghanistan and being provided to Afghans to consume will degrade in quality and will lose a lot of heirloom strains that people haven't discovered yet. For a lot of people that don't know, Afghanistan has always been a source of wonderful indica specific genetics. And it's kind of one of the oldest areas of the world where continuous cannabis cultivation is taking place. If the Taliban were to engage an effective ban, it would damage those sources of those genetics, and it would damage the ability for farmers to export their crop or sell it internally. However, and that's one case, that would be the worst case. And then the second thing that could happen is that the Taliban finds itself desperately in search of liquid capital, because I would imagine that, I don't know if anyone knows this, but military offensives are incredibly expensive. Would imagine that a lot of capital has been flooding out of Afghanistan as people who can't afford to leave do. And so I would say that the Taliban may need to allow or even incentivize cannabis and poppy production in order to fund to provide a tax base, as it were, during their transition. Now, after this transitionary period, I have no idea. Like I said, the modern Taliban is making an effort to portray itself as a kinder and gentler Taliban.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
I don't think they are, but maybe if they're trying to portray that image, maybe they'll allow cannabis cultivation to continue. And I mean, and you got to remember, the Taliban is an organization of people. So people smoke cannabis. So I don't know what their leadership will decide. Mm-hmm. We're very uncertain right now. I think in 3 months, we'll be able to have this conversation again. But Western scholars will not be in, I don't think they'll be in Afghanistan for a while. So what we really need is to kind of, well, once people start going back into Afghanistan, we need to ask them what they're seeing and what they're seeing, because my hope is that the Taliban will leave cannabis alone. And there's many projects during the last 20 years that are kind of, funded and crowdfunded to try to save some of the genetics from the areas around the Hindu Kush and in southern Afghanistan for posterity. And I know that those have been met with some success. So I hope that those seed banks can continue to flourish, even if the Taliban do successfully eradicate some of the heirloom strains of cannabis in Afghanistan. But we don't even know if that's what they're going to do. Mm. It's very uncertain right now.
Yeah, because, 91 was a long time ago. That's 30 years. And 20 years ago when we first went in there, that's a long time. A lot has happened in that 20 years of cannabis. Even since 91, we have medical cannabis. So it just kind of popped in my head when you were talking there. What if the Taliban has been paying attention to this green rush out there? And what if they actually get it going and take an approach like Colombia and actually start cultivating cannabis and selling it, like you were saying? I don't know. I mean, I know they're not dumb. It just seems like that would be a good thing for them to kind of improve their image, like you were talking about, and to preserve those strains and to kind of make Afghanistan more of a cannabis hub, because it's right up there. It's like the Emerald Triangle here in California. You know, you got Afghanistan, Colombia, and you got some African strains, and you got a couple, some in Asia and stuff, but Afghanistan is certainly the center of this. Wouldn't that be fascinating if the Taliban looked around and started joining this green rush? What would you think about that, Dig?
Well, you know, the Taliban is a repressive regime, but I would like them to be friendly to cannabis. But I think anyone who wants to do business with them is going to have to endure a little moral distress, because they do horrible things.
Yeah, definitely. No, I'm not trying to portray the Taliban for being any kind of good organization.
Yeah,
but
I would think it would be intelligent for them to at least embrace cannabis as in the short term.
Yeah, so we'll come back to this. It was really fascinating to hear you talk a little bit more about Afghanistan, and I just wish that it was a little more not the way it is, because, you know, Afghanistan has not been given the chance, and I know 100 years, probably way longer than that. At least from Western cultures over there messing with them, they really have not had even a chance to build a civil society, because they're always getting invaded and they're always getting attacked, and they're always, they had Russia and then the United States. So I'm hoping that the world maybe try to take a different approach to this. And yeah, we might have the Taliban for 15, 20 years, but maybe if we could leave the people alone and get something going over there. Because I just saw they had a protest over there. Now, the Taliban broke it up and killed somebody. And that's real terrible for sure. But they're breaking up protests, killing people here in the United States. And it would be great if maybe we did see a little protest movement get going in Afghanistan.
That would be nice. I know that there are rumors that some of the old elements of the Afghan government are forming an insurgency right now. I heard a rumor this morning that the vice president has a militia together and they've taken back some territory from the Taliban. So there's going to be nascent conflict, at least for the next 3 months, as the Taliban have to, you know, quell uprisings and stuff. They've taken Afghanistan. Now they have to hold it. So we'll see what happens.
All right, folks, right here on Radio Tacoma at the Cannabis Corner, some information out of Afghanistan. Thank you so much, Dig, and I really appreciate, I don't know if I want to say thank you for your service, but I definitely appreciate your the time that you went over there and your effort to, you know, build in the military, and I'm really glad you made it through all that craziness, man.
I appreciate it, yeah.
All right, so we are going to get on to our last segment of our show, and that is our It's a Bus segment. And this is right out of Diggs' area and our area up here in the Northwest. And I guess you'd say it's in the Emerald Triangle, Dig. They had another big bus down there in your area, but it wasn't outdoor this time. It was a warehouse that they went to and they busted. Give us the details on this bus they had down there, Dig.
Okay, so in the little southern Oregon hamlet of Central Point, they found 6,000 pounds of processed marijuana. They believe it's worth $15 million on the black market. So they found a warehouse with tons and tons and tons of processed cannabis. And I'm looking at pictures of this warehouse, and all of the boxes that they've put these bags of cannabis in appear to have Home Depot labels on them.
Oh.
They found 6,000 pounds of processed cannabis, $5,000 in cash, and they arrested one person in this warehouse. So they are upping enforcement in the Southern Oregon area. I assume they're upping enforcement elsewhere as well. There's a real, real aggressive drive, at least in the Southern Oregon area, I'm sure in other local law enforcement agencies, to focus eradication efforts on unlicensed grows. They're being very aggressive.
Yeah, we are in a very critical time on this, because we're in a place where the government is actually going to get into the business of busting cannabis grows, not because they don't like cannabis, but of course they don't, but because the unlicensed grows are taking tax money. And the capitalist cannabis growers and the big cannabis firms, which are taking over. I was just reading a story, California cannabis is in jeopardy for the mega growers coming in. these folks are going to start funding law enforcement to go in and bust their competition. And we're really in a critical time here, and we have to make sure that we fall on the right side of this, because we don't want to just continue this out there massive drug war. This is not what cannabis legalization is all about. It's not about tax money. It's about getting people out of prison. And I hate to say this word, and everybody says it all the time. It's about freedom. It's about being able to do what you want to do and not go to prison. I traveled all over the United States smoking cannabis, hanging out with people here and there in my 20s. Nobody ever said, hey, let's legalize weed so we can get tax money. You know what I mean?
No, it was always, let's legalize weed so that the police will leave us alone and stop doing terrorist shit at home.
That's right. And so we really are trying to impart to people that listen to this show and the people that are interested in cannabis and interested in justice and the law that we have to continue to fight cannabis. Cannabis is not legal in Washington State. If you are found by the police with 1.1 ounces of cannabis, they can take you to jail. If you're found with cannabis outside of a 502 package, you can get in trouble. And they are busting people outside. You know, I don't know if people know this. All over Washington State, you can't sell cannabis. They don't have the stores. So if you're busted around there, you can get in trouble. So we really have to be careful here, Dig, with these police actions continuing. And this is also coming down from Joe Biden, too.
Oh, yeah, the original drug warrior himself. You want to talk about an OG. Joe Biden's been anti-cannabis and pro-private prisons as long as he's been a political actor.
This is very true. And so that's why we continue to do this It's a Bus. And I have to tell you, I was looking around for It's a Bus for a minute, because like we keep finding, it's sometimes a little harder and harder to find these stories. Hey, I would encourage the audience to Google Maine large-scale cannabis bus. There's like two. So there are some states out there doing this well, but right now the West Coast and Oregon is not one of them. It's really cranking up out here, and it's a problem. And thank you for joining us today on the Cannabis Corner, and I'd like to thank Dig for his interview. And if you wanted to like to get in touch with me, you can contact Radio Tacoma at info@radiotacoma.org and put Cannabis Corner into the subject. And if people want to get in touch with you, Dig, and listen to your podcast, The Bagseat Chronicle, which is really great, folks. If you have not tuned in to Dig's Bagseat Chronicle, it gives you a lot of information out of there, out of Southern Oregon cannabis growing, and does some pretty good interviews, too. So you can find that where, Dig?
Yeah, you can go anywhere where you get podcasts. Just search for Bagseat Chronicles, and it should come up. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. As well, if you don't want to do that and you just want to get in touch with me, you can check me out on Instagram at Uncle Dig. If you want to see what's going on in my garden, you can email me at UncleDig4@gmail.com.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH, Radio Tacoma.